We're doing Ein Yaakov. And we had a very long class introducing this concept, the idea that there are things which Hashem does not command, but indicates. We have copies up here if you guys would like, of the Ein Yaakov. And there are things that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to figure out, this is what Hashem wants, even though Hashem didn't command him to do it, such as separating from his wife. Shavar et aluchot. The second thing is, he broke the two tablets. The first two tablets were extraordinary. What was on the first two tablets? What else was on the first two tablets? So it would seem only the Ten Commandments. We have a tradition that the letters were moving, and all of the oral law was there on the Ten Commandments. It's pretty mind-boggling, this idea that there's something physical that God gives this world, the Ten Commandments. So Moshe has these in his hands, and he breaks them. My darash. So again, the Talmud's approach is Moshe didn't invent the concept. He figured it out. He was able to derive that this is what Hashem wants him to do from somewhere. How did he know that? Amar, Moshe said the following reasoning. Uma Pesach, we have the mitzvah to bring the paschal offering. Shu'achad mitoyag mitzvot, it's only one of the 613. And yet the Torah states, Amra Torah, kol ben nechar lo yochal bo. If someone is the son of a nechar, what is a nechar? Gentile, foreigner, the son of a foreigner may not eat from the paschal offering. So what does that mean? That means not only someone who is not Jewish, it also means someone who doesn't behave Jewish. Nechar means stranger. Stranger in Hebrew means he behaves like a stranger. He could be born Jewish, but if he doesn't behave like a Jew, if he is nechar, he is a foreigner to the Jewish way of behaving, the idea here is a mumar. It's talking about someone who is aware of Torah and decides he's not keeping it. So then he's not allowed to eat from the paschal offering either. So Moshe said, if a Jew that ceases to observe the Torah is prohibited from eating from the paschal offering, and that's only one mitzvah, kol ha-Torah kula, all of the Torah is right here. And Yisrael mumarim, and now the Jews are denying Hashem. They're worshipping a golden calf. Alachat kama v'chama, certainly that they have no right to it. So that was his derivation. First of all, we see in the Talmud, it's almost explicit in Talmud, the opinion of the Geonim. We have a question. What's unique about the Ten Commandments? How are they different than any other mitzvah in Torah? It would seem they're part of the 613. Honor your father and mother. Okay, there are many mitzvot. So what's unique about these 10? Thou shalt not covet. What's unique about that? Don't steal. What's unique? So Rav Haigon said that all 613 mitzvot are encapsulized by these 10. These 10 are really an encapsulization of all 613, and he wrote a song to illustrate it. All the laws of damages are really a derivative of the idea. I can't steal from someone else. Returning someone's lost object is also a derivative. So Rav Haigon wrote a song that shows how all 613 are really encompassed by these 10. And some Sephardi communities have a custom till today that on Shavuot morning, when they read the Ten Commandments, before they start reading the Ten Commandments, Shavuot morning is when we receive the Ten Commandments, they read this song, all 613 mitzvot Shavuot morning. The Gemara seems to say what Rav Haigon says, because the Gemara says the whole Torah. The Gemara views the two tablets with the Ten Commandments as the whole Torah. Rashi says the whole Torah is contingent on these tablets. So Rashi might not learn exactly like Rav Haigon. Our sages say that the two tablets represented the engagement. They say, what's it similar to? The king was dating a princess, things were going well. He decides he wants to marry her, so he sends a marriage contract with their mutual friend. And their mutual friend shows up to the princess and he finds her with a lover. So he says, if I give her the marriage contract, the king will kill her. What'll I do? I'll tear up the marriage contract. Come back to the king and say, no deal right now. And if he wants to engage her later, he'll engage her later. And then there won't be a problem because she was with a lover. So to Moshe Rabbeinu comes down the mountain and he has the marriage contract. He has the two tablets. He finds the Jewish people with a golden calf. So he breaks the two tablets. That's the Medrash. That certainly sounds Again, Rashi says the whole Torah is contingent on the tablets. He doesn't say the whole Torah is encapsulized, encompassed by the tablets. So it could be that's what Rashi is alluding to. Before we take questions, it's worth noting, there's also Nachmanides' opinion. The Talmud says we learn the laws of conversion from the Jewish people, because the Jewish people underwent a conversion at Sinai. The sacrifice, they all circumcised, and they were purified like a ger goes to mikvah, and they were given a sampling of the mitzvos. What sampling were they given? So Nachmanides holds, Ramban says that the Ten Commandments are a sampling. You want to know what I'm going to tell you? Here are the Ten Commandments. Here you have the basic Jewish philosophy, Anochi Hashem Lokecha, I'm the only one. Lo Yielecho, you can't worship any others. And then you have a sampling. We say when a ger wants to convert. So nowadays, people want to convert, we tell them, come learn everything. You got to know what you're getting yourself into, see if you can do it. But that's not really what used to be. It's only since the state, before the state of Israel. So who wanted to convert? It was dangerous. It was economically difficult. Jews were not allowed to own land. You lost a lot by converting. So in ancient times, if a person wanted to convert, up until the declaration of the state, ever since the days of King Solomon, meaning only in the golden era of Judaism do we have these limitations where we say, hey, wait a second, let's not do the process so fast. In ancient times, you wanted to convert, so you'd get a sampling. Here are some of the mitzvos, some of the harder mitzvos, some of the easier mitzvos. Here's what Jewish philosophy believes in. It's a class you could do in about 2 days. You cover all of that. Now you still want to convert? It's a bad idea. It'll be bad for you. It'll be difficult for you. It's dangerous for you. You lose a lot. There's persecution against the Jews. We explain to a person what he loses by it. And after we do that two or three times, if the person still insists they want to convert, they can do it. The whole process can take a week or two finished. Today, no, we have Machon Meir's gear department. You have to enroll. You have to go and go to the state and go to the Rabbanut. And it's a whole long process. Part of the reason behind it is that today there's all kinds of temptations for a person to convert for the wrong reasons. So they make the process more lengthy. But technically, halachically, does a person have to know the whole Torah in order to convert? No. But wait a second. They come out of mikvah, and they have to keep Shabbos, and they don't yet know how. If you didn't study the laws of Shabbos for a year or two, you don't know what you're doing on Shabbos. I mean, you could take a hair out of your soup, and you don't realize you're doing borer. You could take a fly out of your soup, you don't realize it's borer. You're making yourself tea, you squeeze out the tea bag, you don't realize that that's prohibited. You could squeeze a lemon into your tea, you don't know that's prohibited. There are a million things you could do wrong, unintentionally, with the best intentions. Like a friend of mine told me, he was standing Shabbos, and he was keeping Shabbos, and everyone went to nap Shabbos afternoon, and he took out, what do they call that thing where you put a canvas on, an easel? What's it called? The stand? Easel, it's called? Great. Yeah, he took out an easel, he took out a canvas, he takes out his paintbrush and paints, and the girl of the family where he was staying by is like 6, 7 years old, and he starts painting a picture on Shabbos, and she looks at him and she says, "It's Shabbos!" And he looks at her and he says, "I know!" And she says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "What's wrong?" And she says, "You're not allowed to paint on Shabbos." He says, "Really?" Okay, he put away his paintbrush and felt like a total fool. You know, the 6-year-old is looking at him and saying, "It's Shabbos." Okay, but technically, halachically, that's going to happen to every convert. The halacha says, before you convert, you don't have to learn everything. You have to know a sampling. Today, we say you should know more, but that's only recent. Up until 50 years ago, you didn't go to this course. You studied for a few days, a week or two. So, says Ramban, this idea, before a person converts, they have to know a little bit about what Judaism is all about. They have to understand the philosophy. They have to know the general concept of what they're getting themselves into. That's the Ten Commandments, says Ramban. The Ten Commandments are a sampling. You want to know what Judaism is all about. So we've seen two or three approaches. We've seen Rav Haigon, that the Ten Commandments encompass everything. We saw the Ramban. And now Rashi might be something a little different. The idea that everything's contingent on it, the marriage contract. That the Ten Commandments have a special place, but they might not be all encompassing. Nonetheless, they have a special place. Yes?
Rashi's understanding of the Ten Commandments, doesn't it seem a little strange? There are a couple of midrashim, and the Gemara talks about how it seems like creation was contingent on that, to do
What do you mean, come back later?
Like, they tore up the marriage contract. The messenger tore up. He said, oh, we'll do it next month or something. We'll do it later. But it wasn't...
Not exactly, because on the 6th of Sivan was not the tablets. The 6th of Sivan was when Am Yisrael said, Naseh v'nishma. That was the Kiddushin. The 6th of Sivan was when Hashem said, V'atem tiyuli mamlecht kohanim v'goy kadosh. Hashem gave us the Ten Commandments orally. We heard the Ten Commandments. And then the Jewish people accepted to be the chosen nation. And that's equated with the idea of getting engaged. Then Moshe is supposed to come back with the ksuba, with the marriage contract. That's what happens 40 days later with the golden calf. Right?
Yeah. Even though ironically, I'm saying with the marriage contract, the golden calf is the...
That's Shiva Aser B'Tammuz. Who said it was canceled? The next step wasn't taken. He ripped up the next step, not the previous step. Kiddushin, the engagement, the connection of the Jewish people to Hashem as being the chosen people. What happens at a wedding ceremony? You first put a ring on her finger, and you do the first step, which says, you are now designated to me. You are. I take the responsibility of being there for you. I will take care of you. Kiddushin, we've sanctified the relationship between us. Now we have to be faithful to one another. Then there's the next step, which is Nisun, which means we're going to live in a house together. We're going to be a family. Step one is we're designated to one another, what we call engagement. We do both at a marriage ceremony, but technically they're two stages. And they used to wait a year in between them. So if Kiddushin is the engagement, what halachic engagement, not what people call engagement today, so that's what happened when Hashem gave the Ten Commandments. He said, do you want to be my chosen people? We said yes. And now we're obligated to Hashem. Hashem says, Anochi Hashem Lokecha. The next step, when we become, so to speak, a family, the Nisuin, the conclusion of the marriage, that next step wasn't taken. Wasn't taken yet. Right? That's the idea of a chuppah. Okay. So how do we know Hashem agreed with Moshe that Moshe broke the tablets? Because the pasuk says, "Asher shibarta." Hashem says the tablets you broke, and Reish Lakish taught, "Yesher koch sheshibarta." That Hashem said to him, "You should have even more strength. It was a good move that you broke them." So we read the word "asher" like "yasher." I approve of it that you broke them. Why do we tell a person "yesher koch"? When they finish their aliyah, person goes down from making a blessing on the Torah, we tell him Yeshur Koach. Here you have the words Yeshur Koach. Hashem told Moshe, Yeshur Koach, your strength should be straightened, your strength should be improved, because you broke the tablet. So why do we tell a person Yeshur Koach when they come off of making the blessing on the Torah? So one explanation that's given is because a person might feel weakened. I was just up there with the Torah. Now I have to leave. So we tell him, you should still be strong. Yeshur Koach. You should be strong. Don't take it so hard that you had to leave the Torah. You had to go down. Okay. Yeshur Koach. Back to the Ein Yaakov. Tashma v'yunchunim na yom ha-shlishi kasher Rabbi Yossi. Amrin yom ha-chad osif v'shem dato. The Gemara says, ultimately, what we said in the beginning, that Moshe Rabbeinu added the third day of separation because he understood what Hashem wanted, that the Jewish people should be pure. I'm not going over it again. We discussed that last week. Tanya, we have a braisa. What's a braisa? Tanya is the beginning of a braisa. It's a quote from the Tanaic period that was not included in the Mishnah. It says, Vayashav Moshe Tivraham El Hashem. Moshe comes back to report to Hashem. The Jewish people say they want to be your people. They want to accept your Torah. V'chtiv, we have another pasuk that says, Vayiged Moshe Tivraham El Hashem. Moshe told over what the people had said, he said it to Hashem. So why one time it says Vayashev, he brought it back, one time it says Vayaged, he told it over. Why two terminologies? Ma amar le'akadosh baruch hu l'moshe, ma amar l'moshe l'Yisrael. What did God tell Moshe? What did Moshe tell the people? Uma amru Yisrael l'moshe, what did the people tell Moshe? Uma yashiv Moshe l'fnei ha'gvura. We have a four-step process. God speaks to Moshe, Moshe speaks to the people. The people speak to Moshe, Moshe speaks to God. What happened there? What was said in this interchange? זו מצוות הגבלה. דברי רבי יוסי ברבי יהודה. רבי יוסי ברבי יהודה says, the point was, separate yourself. Be careful. There's a mountain. God's going to appear on the mountain. Don't rush up that mountain. Stay away from the bottom of the mountain. Rabbi Yossi omer, b'tchila piresh onsha. Initially, Hashem tells them, be careful what the punishment is. T'chtivi Hashem Moshe, dvarim shem shavevin da'ato shel adam. The first thing is, he spoke to them things that would prevent them from complaining. So Moshe comes and tells them, be careful. Anyone that climbs the mountain gets killed. And this is a... ulvasof piresh matan tzchara. And afterwards he told them, and you know what you'll get if you listen? Now that's a very important concept in education. Education, very often we're tempted to keep everything positive. That's good. It's good to keep everything positive. And then one day you see your kid playing with a fork and the socket and trying to stick the fork in the socket. So now you're going to be positive. You're going to say, sweetie, let's play a different game. Maybe we should play something else with the fork. The socket's not made for that. That's not such a good idea. Because if you're going to be so sweet and gentle, then when you're not looking, he might stick that fork in the socket. He's just trying to see if he can fit it in. Sometimes when you're dealing with something dangerous, you have to make sure that there's no room for error. And that's why in education there are times where the first thing you have to do is make sure you're listened to. Next, you could talk about sweetness and positive. My kids were once walking ahead of me. We were walking to take them to school, and they're walking ahead on the sidewalk. I'm about two cars' lengths behind them. And I see as they're walking, there's a car that seemed parked on the side of the street. Suddenly it starts moving. And before I could say anything, the kids pull off to the side away from the car. Now, I'm running and trying to yell. What am I supposed to yell at that point? Am I supposed to say, kids, sweethearts, just be careful, that car's about to kill you. Not such a good idea. You want to make sure that right now they move, right? So you want to yell something that they're going to listen to now. Later on, you could explain. But on that moment, so the end of the story is interesting. I went up to the kids and I said, I'm so proud of you. That was so beautiful. How did you know? So they said, you know, you and him always taught us that before we approach a car, we should pay attention if it's moving, if its lights are on. And if it is, then we should move away. So we noticed that the car was on. We could tell, we could hear, we were closer. So we pulled away. So I said, great, remind me when we get home, you're each going to get an ISIS. I come home, and my wife tells me that I'm messing up her chinuch, and she's right. She said to the kids, it was obvious that they should do that. When you reward them, now you've made it into this great thing that they did. You don't have to reward them for doing what's right. There are things that should be obvious to them. I've been working to make it obvious. You see a car is on. You see the car there, it might move. Pull away. Don't continue moving. Stay on the side till Abba or Ima catch up to you. And then you'll decide whether to go or not. Don't reward them for it. Because then it becomes something, oh, wow, that's a great thing. So sometimes you do it and sometimes you don't. So that's also an interesting point in Chinuch. Here, Moshe teaches us there are circumstances where it's correct to punish if they don't do. And it's correct to reward if they do. And yet, Moshe begins with the punishment. Because first you got to make sure they don't do what's wrong. And so, in circumstances where it would endanger the person, the first thing you got to do is make sure they don't do it. And very often in chinuch, parents think they could always explain. They could always be sweet and nice. And that's not true. Because there will be times where it's critical that the kid listens to you, even if he doesn't understand you. You're driving down the highway and you notice your kid is sticking his head out the window. It's dangerous. People have died that way. People have lost their head that way. And you don't always have control over it. You're driving. If you're going to try to explain to him right now, you might not get that explanation in. But you do need the kid to listen. You need him to stick his head in the window. Right? So now what? There has to be this understanding in our education that there are times that you listen, even if you don't understand, and you can't always be sweet. So the Gemara says that's why Moshe begins with Vayoshev Moshe. He begins with Dvarim Shem Shavevin Dato Shel Adam. He began with things that prevent a person from complaining. First, you got to listen. You do like it, you don't like it, it's irrelevant. This is what you got to do. Ulvasof. In the end, Piresh Matan Tzchara. Then he goes on to explain, and you know, if you do it, then Hashem is still going to reward your dichtiv. Vayged Moshe Dvarim Shem Moshchin Libo Shel Adam Kaagada. Ultimately, Moshe said it in a way that was pleasant to listen to, just like telling a story, that people are more apt to listen when you tell a story. It draws a person's attention. Moshe also went on to that level of explanation. He said it over to the people in a way that they were interested in listening. But he didn't start that way. So that's the first explanation of how Moshe spoke to the people. Ve'ika d'amri. Others say, "B'tchina piresh matan tzchara." He began by telling them what they'd get for it. "Tichtiv yashem Moshe dvarim shemeshivin datosh nadam." "Uvasof piresh onsha tichtiv ayged Moshe dvarim shekashin nadam kegidin." The other opinion says the exact opposite. No, Moshe wasn't hard pressed at that moment to make sure they don't go up the mountain, so he was able to begin with pleasantries. He began by telling them, "You know how good it'll be if you're careful not to go up the mountain." And the second opinion says there wasn't a time constraint. He had the time to first explain it pleasantly and then go on and say, and you should just know that if you don't, whoever's going to climb that mountain will die. So that's the second opinion. And there are two approaches which are legitimate. There are times where you have the time. Well, if you have the time, then why not be positive? Why do you have to be negative? You know, why threaten? A friend of mine dated a girl, and he couldn't figure out whether to marry her, and his main peeve with her was that he saw that when her little sister tried to pet a dog, she said to the girl, "Don't touch him, he'll bite you." And he said, she's always saying things to the kids in a negative way. You could say, "I don't want you to touch him," but to always work with threats and fear, and this will happen, and that'll happen, that's not the way to approach kids. I'm giving an example, but in general, the second approach is also important. When possible, we come sweetly. There's no point in coming down hard. There are parents who tell their kids, "Do it now." Well, there are times that you're going to have to tell your kid, "Do it now." But you shouldn't always be saying, "Do it now." I want you to clean your room now. If you begin with the now, then what are you going to do when they don't do it? If you say, "Could you please clean your room?" And then you come back and you say, "You know, I asked you, do I have to ask you a second time?" And then you say, "You know, I want you to do it now." So you've moved forward. But if you start right away, "Clean your room now." Why? So the second interpretation says Moshe had the time. So he began positive. He began by saying, "Look, it's going to be great. You just got to be careful not to go up the mountain." And then he said, "And by the way, you should just know that if you do, there is this punishment waiting. I mean, people who climb the mountain will die." And again, both approaches are legitimate depending on where a person's standing. What did we learn today? We began with Moshe breaking the luchos. He derived it from the Paschal offering. If a person who reneges his faith can't have the Paschal offering, the Jewish people who reneged their faith could definitely not accept the whole Torah. We spoke about three interpretations of the Ten Commandments. What's unique about them? Rav Haigon, they encompass the whole Torah. Ramban, they're a sampling of mitzvos. And Rashi, that says everything's contingent on it. Then we went on to describe that Hashem agreed with him and said Yishur Koach for breaking it. We discussed that Yishur Koach, we wish a person when they finish their aliyah, because they've come down from a high, so we say you should still have strength. Then we went on to the transition of conversation. Hashem tells Moshe, Moshe tells the people, the people tell Moshe, Moshe tells Hashem. And we said either Moshe began by threatening them because it was dangerous, and only afterwards could he explain to them the benefits, or he had the time and he began by telling them the benefits, and he concluded with the warning of what the threat, what the danger would be if they would climb the mountain.